Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this truly exciting evening as the Sam Houston State University Symphony Orchestra writes a tiny little bit of music history. My name is Mario Aschauer. I'm assistant professor of musicology in our school and more widely known as the early music guy because I direct the Center for Early Music Research and Performance, short CEMRAP. Tonight, I'm also here as the proud member of the advisory board of the new Bruckner edition in Vienna, from which I'm extending the best regards. I'm among the daddies, very proud daddies, of this newborn baby. It's the very first, pretty big, isn't it? It's the very first volume of the new Bruckner edition containing the very first version of the Bruckner's very first symphony that he counted himself. Just recently edited newly by Thomas Roeder, based on newly found and newly explored sources. It came yesterday in the mail, so I'm really, really excited that we have it here. I'm even more proud that it is our students and our orchestra to get to introduce this new version of the symphony to this side of the Atlantic Ocean. The reception of Bruckner's music has always struck me as a very interesting phenomenon, because already during his lifetime and to this very day, there's basically only two groups of Bruckner listeners: those who love and adore his music and those who simply hate it. Very strong sentiments already expressed by Hans von Bülow, who is otherwise known in music history as the guy whose wife divorced him to marry Wagner. But he also coined the famous dictum about Bruckner, saying that to him, Bruckner is half genius and half idiot. Very strong sentiments, which is probably the reason why internationally, Bruckner does not have quite the same rank yet as some of the other composers, although he really would deserve it. Even the music history textbook that we use in America, a 1,000-page heavy textbook, dedicates only one tiny little paragraph to Bruckner, and half of the information that's in there is actually inaccurate. So I suppose you have already figured out what camp of the two I am in, and I would like to offer you tonight my reasoning for why I think Bruckner is an amazing composer and the First Symphony is certainly an incredible symphony. Bruckner was born into a family of school teachers in rural Upper Austria in 1824. His dad was a school teacher, his grandfather was a school teacher, his uncle, his cousin, all of them were school teachers, which makes the symphony even greater for us because also these people here are gonna be school teachers, most of them at least. And so little Tony also wanted to become a school teacher. Now, school teacher in post-Maria Theresian Austria in the early 19th century meant that there are at least teachers and organists, and also sacristans, and also farmers. Most of them had a little goat and a cow and some chicken. And so music was a huge part of teacher training in Austria in the early 19th century. And in fact, for the first 30 years of his life, Bruckner really pursued the career of a school teacher. He became assistant teacher in several small little villages that even are tiny today. So just imagine what they were like in 1830 and 40. And then he worked himself up basically back to where he came from and where he went to school at the Benedictine Monastery of St. Florian in Upper Austria, where people started to realize that this guy really had talent, and he became assistant organist there. And was really respected for his organ playing, so that in 1855, he was offered the position of cathedral organist in Linz, my hometown. And quite frankly, it's still a rather small town. But for Bruckner, it was an incredible step outside of his rural environment to take this position. And he wasn't quite sure if that was gonna work out. And so he asked the abbot of St. Florin to actually keep his job in St. Florin open for 3 years just in case things don't work out. Pretty quickly, though, Bruckner realized that, yes, it actually could work, and I could become a professional musician and make my living from being a musician. So he embarked on a 10-year journey of study to become a composer. 6 years, he studied with Simon Sechter, who at the time was the major composition and theory professor in Vienna. He had just published a 3-volume treatise on composition, and so he was the man you wanted to study with when you wanted to become a composer. And Bruckner knew that, and he got in touch with him, and Sechter was crazy about Bruckner, and so he studied with him for 6 years. But Sechter required that he not compose a single piece until he was done. Then, after Bruckner graduated from Sechter, he found Otto Kitzler, who at the time was the theater Kapellmeister, whom he thought could teach him instrumentation, more form, and also compositional work technique. So all in all, 10 years, during which at some point, Bruckner must have gotten infected. Infected with the symphonic virus, and with the idea of becoming a symphonic composer, a symphonist. Now you see, after Beethoven in the 1830s and 40s, the symphony was a problem. I mean, where were you gonna take the symphony after Beethoven's Ninth Symphony? And in fact, it went so far that some theorists even claimed around 1850 that the symphony is basically dead, because what can you really say? Which then made for some of the composers at the time to come up with really creative solutions for new symphonic music. Just think of Liszt and Richard Strauss, and then ultimately also Gustav Mahler, who came up with new solutions for the symphony that are mainly, though, inspired by extra musical programs. It's program music. Bruckner had a completely different vision for the symphony, however. And it's so different that it makes it truly anachronistic. He thought, I don't need the programs. I want to go back to the roots. In some ways, actually, back to the roots to the late Middle Ages. He went back to the basic 4-movement structure of the symphony and composed music that is entirely unprogrammatic. Instead, he wanted to use purely musical means to create a symphonic movement that includes counterpoint, contrapuntal techniques, and so-called motivic labor. What that is, I'll show you in a moment. With the goal to achieve a musically coherent development that's arching over all the 4 movements of a symphony. Great, what does that mean? The First Symphony of Bruckner is actually a great example to show this. First of all, Bruckner was really proud of this symphony. So proud that although he liked to revise his symphonic projects in later years, he didn't change all that much in the First Symphony, actually, because in other symphonies, he even exchanged entire movements. And Bruckner, remember, was already 40 when he wrote his First Symphony, so he wasn't exactly a rookie in composition, but he kind of knew where he was going, and the First Symphony is really already a pretty complete expression thereof. The 4-movement model, 4 pieces to make a symphony, was established or was formulated as such in the 1830s when distilling from Beethoven's music. It includes a first movement in so-called sonata form, a second movement, slow movement, a third movement with a scherzo and a trio, and a fourth movement as a finale. Bruckner himself referred to his first symphony in German as Keckes Basel, which is basically impossible to translate. It means a saucy little broom, which is an insider joke, which is also part of the reason why on some of your invitation cards we put a little broom, in case you wondered, this is why. In the Bruckner literature, it's much more appropriately translated as saucy maid, which isn't quite the same thing. But what's saucy about this? Bruckner thought already the beginning of the symphony was really saucy. a very shameless little theme coming in without any preparation, a really saucy accompaniment, and the idea that the theme actually doesn't occur in one instrument or in one group of instruments, but is actually being commented, like other instruments weigh in on this first theme immediately. In this case, actually, it's first the horn, and then later other instruments come in and almost like give comments on this theme. Let's hear the theme. Let's look at the character of this theme. There's some tongue-in-cheekness about this, isn't it? Especially the short, long, short, long. And in fact, if you had to boil down this entire symphony, it would be short, long, or long, short. And we're going to talk about this a little more in a moment. This is the one thing. The other character is, you hear the low strings and the comments and the horn and the other woodwinds. The short long theme occurs already in the second theme. Second theme sounds like this. Here, long. Short. The first motive that we hear in the second movement is also long, short. 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 So you can already see the idea of musical coherence, that you don't really realize it, but it's there. It's the underlying motive for Bruckner's way of composing. Originally, by the way, Bruckner sketched a completely different scherzo for the symphony. And we have both the instrumentation, but also his very, very first piano sketch. I don't think it has ever been performed before, so you're actually tonight in for a Bruckner world premiere with the piano sketch of the original scherzo. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Here's the original scherzo. Bad scherzo, is it? A little rough, maybe. But why did Bruckner choose to not use it? Let's listen to the scherzo that he actually put in the symphony.
Thank you.
Why is this bitter? Remember the short long? The other scherzo started like this. It's all short. This theme, short long. Then, did you listen to the accompaniment? The low strings were all. Remember the beginning of the first movement? Same kind of character. And also, again, wind instruments were chiming in on the theme of the scherzo. And voila, much more coherence musically is achieved. I mentioned earlier that Bruckner really liked to revise his symphonic projects. And in fact, in the summer of 1890, he was again revising his first symphony. At the time, he had already moved to Vienna. He had become a professor of music theory at the conservatory and the university, and he was imperial court organist. As such, he was asked to play at an imperial wedding. The daughter of the emperor, the Archduchess Marie Valerie, married, and Archduke Franz Salvator, and Bruckner was asked to play organ, a processional and a recessional. And Bruckner said, great, I'm gonna improvise. And they said, it's not that great. You can't just play whatever you like. We want to see what you're gonna play first. Now, mind you, Bruckner had celebrated major successes as organ improviser in Paris and in London, but the court administration was not happy. So they said, okay, you're gonna submit a sketch of what you're gonna be playing. And so he did, and this is the sketch. Now, what did you think the court administration said when they thought about the Archduchess walking down the aisle to this music? They said, no way. Bruckner did get to play the organ, but they said, no, you're just gonna improvise on the national anthem and that's it. Why did they think it was inappropriate? Why was it rejected? Because it was too symphonic. Now guess what the main theme of the finale of the first symphony is? That's it. Exactly. It is the main theme of the finale. And again, it's a long, short thing. Dum, ba-bum. Now I said the main theme. Are there other themes? How does this work anyway? I mentioned earlier that Bruckner learned sonata form from a music theorist of the mid-19th century by the name of Johann Christian Lobe, what he distilled from Beethoven's music to make sense of sonata form. And Lobe describes the sonata form in two parts. Part one has a main theme, which you've just heard, and the main theme group. Then it's a transitional group, and then he calls it a vocal group. There's a second theme, like the yin to the yang of the first theme, something much more vocal than this rather strong, more male first theme, rather female second theme. Let's hear the beginning of the vocal group with the second theme. You'll hear the theme in the first violin, and the viola plays the counter theme, as it were, which is basically just quarter notes and quarter rests. Let's listen to this. So there's two characters in this little theme. It's got the chord, and then its little tail with the trill. Now, the closing group closes this part, and then we come to the development, in which each of the themes and their counter themes are musically developed. The composer can play around with them. And some of this playing I would like to show you. This first example is about a contrapuntal technique. Again, completely musical, no extra musical idea, is the inversion of the theme. All the intervals in the original theme that go down now go up, and vice versa. So the inversion of the theme is, Bruckner composed it in such a way that they actually can be played at the same time. And he was really proud of stuff like that. And he uses the inversion for part of his development section of this theme. The inverted theme is now in the double basses. Let's hear what this sounds like. Here, the inversion and the basses. The second thing that Bruckner plays with is the little tail of the theme, the one with the trill. And this is what we call thematic labor, just cutting off a little particle of a theme and just playing around with this and creating new situations and new colors and new soundscapes with it. The example that I want to play for you shows how he does this with just that little trill. First, the violins pick it up, and then the entire string orchestra is just obsessed with this little trill and creating this wonderful etherical texture of trills. It's also one of the most difficult passages in the symphony, by the way. And the winds then come in and throw in particles from the beginning of the theme with the chord. And then something very typical for Bruckner happens. The horns come in, introducing a theme that we have never heard before. And it's no long short or short long. It's only long, 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 a chorale theme. It's almost as if Bruckner was hinting at something that lies beyond even the most fundamental compositional techniques that have characterized music ever since the late Middle Ages. And the horns, as it were, announce the advent of the apotheosis of the finale. Let's hear what this sounds like.
Thank you.
Now, how the story ends and the symphony, you will see in a few moments after we have reset the stage. Again, I would like to thank you, the Sam Houston State Symphony Orchestra and its genius conductor, Dr. Jacob Sesteda, the entire instrumental faculty, and our director, Scott Pluggy, for making this possible. It's an amazing project and an amazing evening. I hope you will enjoy the performance. Thank you very much.